right, welcome to We Talk Comics. We got another special guest. Welcome back, Rob Venditti, to the show. Writer of The Flash now, and writer of...
Don't you want to, like, tell people who we are?
No, yeah. No, because nobody cares. If you listen,
nobody
to this,
cares.
If you listen to the show, you know exactly who we are.
That's Brett. I'm Mo.
I care. I would like to hear you guys tell me who you are.
Yeah, I bet.
All right, fine. But we don't write The Flash. We don't write Green Lantern. We don't write X-O Man.
Yet,
that's true. And we haven't written Armor Hunters, and theoretically we won't be writing it.
No, that probably not. So, anyways, it's Brett there. I'm Mo. We're, of course, on with... with returning friend of the show, we'll say. Is that fair, Robert Venditti?
Sure, yeah.
It's about 10 and a half months since we last spoke to you. So, yeah. You know, we wanted to talk to you about 10 and a half days later. We wanted to talk to you about 10 and a half hours later.
Maybe great even 10 and a half minutes. But,
yeah, we had so much fun with you last time, so we really appreciate you coming back. That's great. And let's get to it. We have a whole ton to talk about, so.
Yeah.
I know. In 1 year, or in just less than a year, you've been a very busy guy.
Yeah, it's been a pretty busy year. You know, I feel like I've been really fortunate in that regard. You know, what do you say? You know, I get the opportunities to write these kind of books, and I'm always happily surprised by it. You know, and I always feel very fortunate about it. And honestly, I'm having a great time with all of it.
Well, you know, that's actually one of the things that you were telling us last time was how you would last time, like I say, about 10 and a half months ago, you had plotted out XO to like issue 22, and you plotted out several months in advance. So what's an average work week like for you, or work day, especially now you got four books on the go?
Yeah, it's a little bit busier now than it has been in the past. You know, I feel like three books a month is a pretty good slate for me, you know, because I'm not the fastest writer in the world. You know, for me, a good day is writing about four pages. But I also revise as I go. So I'll write those four pages and I'll revise them before the end of the day. And then after I finish the full issue, I'll go back and revise the whole issue again, you know, once or maybe even twice. So the first draft that I turn into an editor is my third or fourth draft, you know. So for me, you know, in addition to the four books I'm working on, and Armor Hunters is only a four-issue miniseries, so that's not an ongoing. I did four books for a very – actually, no, that's not true. I did three books for a brief stint. Yeah. And with The Flash, I'm only co-writing it, you know. So I do 10 of those pages, and Van Jensen does the other 10, and we talk about the stories together and break all that stuff down together. So but on top of that, I also – I'm writing novels right now for Simon & Schuster. I have a two-book novel deal, and so that's where it gets a little hairy, you know. So I'm almost done with Armor Hunters and getting ready to free up some time. The first novel is already done. So, you know, now it's basically I work from about 8:30 in the morning till about 5 in the afternoon. I try to take a little bit of a break for dinner, hang out with the family, and then I go back to work around 9 and work around till midnight or so. Ooh. You know. Yeah.
Good thing to work out at home, then people don't have to smell you. I think that's what you're saying.
Yeah. No, it is. It's a pretty solitary existence. You know, I just work in my office all day. Although, actually, we just put a porch on the back of the house, a nice screened in porch. And that's real nice because I go out there and I work now. And so I'm outside, and we live on a nice wooded lot. So, you know, there's all kinds of birds and trees and everything like that. So the porch just finished on last Wednesday. So it's only been a few days, but now I sit out there all day. So.
Well, you know, people shouldn't have to smell me either, but they do. So, I mean, could be worse.
I'm right next to him. What can I say? Yeah.
Yeah. Where actually do you live in? I'm not sure what city you're in.
I'm north of Atlanta, pretty far north of Atlanta. So almost in like the foothills of the Appalachians, you know.
So is that
kind of rural where I'm at?
About near where The Walking Dead started in the TV show? Is that area?
I want to say that. I mean, I don't know about the filming, but I don't know. I'm terrible with horror. If I watch horror, I get like ruinous nightmares. So I've seen like a couple episodes of The Walking Dead, and it freaked me out so bad I can't watch it anymore. It was very good. It was very well written, but it just freaked me out. But I want to say they started out in Kentucky, but I'm not positive about that. And then he rode to Atlanta, and that's about when I stopped watching. When he got to Atlanta and he was trapped in that tank and there were zombies everywhere, and I tapped out at that point.
All right, well, I think we already got two questions, follow-ups, based on what you said, believe it or not. As Brett, do you want to go first? Or?
Sure. I'm interested in the book deal. You You got I think you said you had a two book deal with Simon & Schuster.
Yeah, it's they're intermediate grade. You know, they call them middle grade intermediate reader novels, which is like the Percy Jackson, the Olympians, Harry Potter age, that kind of thing. It's a story that I've been working on. I had the idea for over 10 years, and I just wasn't really sure what to do with it. You know, I had actually written a draft of it as a comic book, like the first issue of a comic book series, and it just didn't seem to be fitting. You know, my background originally is in prose. That's what I went to college for in grad school, was to be a prose writer. I didn't start reading comics until I was in my late 20s, and so prose is something that I've always sort of my first actually published work was a literary story, a short fiction story I published in the Berkeley Fiction Review, and that was right before I started reading comics. The story was accepted, and in between it getting accepted and it getting published, because there was about a 6-month lag time there, I started reading comics and decided I was going to write comics instead of prose. And so, but prose is something I've always been interested in. And so I started doing the Percy Jackson and Olympians adaptations for Hyperion, where I was taking those novels and turning them into graphic novels. And the editor that I was working with there asked me if I had any ideas for that sort of middle grade style of writing. And it never occurred to me before, but as soon as he said it, it dawned on me, that's what that story is. You know, I didn't realize it, but when he said it, I was like, that's what that story is. And so, yeah, it's a middle grade story about a 7th grade boy who comes into possession of a cape that gives him superpowers. But it all comes with a catch. So the first one will be out in May of 2015. That one's already done. There's going to be an art component to the book as well that's being drawn by Dusty Higgins. And then the second novel will be out in May of 2016.
Is it open-ended so there could be more if it's a success?
It could be, yeah. I don't know. We'll see how they go. But, yeah, it could definitely go, I would say, 4 or 5 at least if we wanted it to, you know.
Yeah, because these things definitely – I know a lot of them blow up right now. They're a popular genre.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully.
Yeah, we're hoping Harry Potter money happens. For you.
Yep.
I'm sorry?
We're hoping you get some Harry Potter money there.
If I get the Harry Potter money, I promise you will never speak to me ever
again. Well, then we really hope you get.
I'm just kidding. I mean, obviously, that stuff is super rare. I mean, it's just like anything. You just hope anybody reads it and enjoys it. You know what I mean? So it's different. Writing prose, it's not, I want to say they don't care, but it doesn't really matter to them that I write Green Lantern or that I wrote The Surrogates, which was adapted into a film or any of that. Like, to them, I am a first-time writer, you know? So it's very much like an entry-level gig in terms of the writing job, you know, which I think is pretty cool. It's like I'm earning my keep all over again, you know, so that's kind of nice. I feel good about it. I like the way the art component's coming out. I like the story. We'll see what happens.
Do you feel like it flexes different creative muscles for you?
It definitely does. You know, I think that there's different strengths and different weaknesses to different mediums, you know. And I think one of the things that novels do really, really well that I don't feel like graphic novels do as well, certainly not with my style of writing, is interiority. You know, when you read a novel, you really get that interiority of the character and what's going through their heads. In a comic book, if you want to do that, you got to have a lot of thought captions. And to me, that really sort of just, you know, it feels like you're being told a story instead of, you know, reading a story.
It's a visual,
you know?
Medium.
Yeah. It's like a voiceover in a movie. You know, it's really hard to pull those off. And I'm not saying it can't be done successfully. I'm just saying that for me and the style of writing that I do, in fact, I've never once in any comic book I've ever written have I ever done a thought caption once, you know. And even with Exo Man of War, I don't know if you guys read the original series, but it was very much Eric was always talking to himself in his head and all this kind of stuff. And when I read the original series and I decided, you know, that I was going to pitch for it in my head, I am never going to have him use an interior caption one single time. I'm going to try to find a way to make that story that was very interior and render it in a way that's going to make it exterior. And I think that's going to keep the action and the pace and everything flowing for the reader, as opposed to just, you know, reading these captions after captions after captions. And like I say, there's obviously writers who do it very well. And I'm not saying I'm not ever going to do it in another story. or anything like that. And who knows, I may, in X-O Man of War, I may find a place where it serves the story really well, and I do decide to do it. But for me, it's just not anything that I feel like I've been able to pull off.
Now, did you read the Acclaim version of X-O Man of War? Because if you wanted thought to, you know, balloons, then they would
nuts.
Be there.
No, I stopped it. You know, I was reading so much. And it was very much a, hey, all right, the pitch is approved. Let's get writing because we want to get Carrie Nord as far ahead as we can, you know. And even though the book didn't come out until May, I started writing it in September of the previous year. And so I think it was 72 issues plus a yearbook was the original XO run, so 73 issues total. I read all of that, and I asked them, you know, do you want me to read – Does VH2, you know, Valiant Universe 2, which is what they call the Acclaim era, does that have anything to do with what we're going to be doing at all? Because if it does, I want to read it. And they said nothing at all. And I was like, okay, then I'm not going to read it because I just didn't have the time to. So I read all the VH1 enjoyment. Stuff. What you say?
You wouldn't read that for enjoyment.
Oh, really?
Well, and technically, it may take you equally as long to read the 20 issues there as the 73 that that came in the VH1 run.
Yeah, but,
really. I know nothing about it.
It's nuts. That's all I'll say to you. So when you're going back and you're self-editing, you say at the end of the day you're rewriting, what is it you're looking for?
I mean, you know, not just typos or anything like that. I'm reading the story and I'm trying to make sure that everything makes sense in terms of what I'm communicating to the artist, but also that the panels, you know, are happening in a way that I think is going to be visual. A lot of dialogue editing, you know, reading the dialogue without reading the panels, just going through and reading it like a conversation and trying to make sure that, you know, the dialogue all reads really well. Dialogue is one of the things that I would say that I'm, and historically, going all the way back to my days writing prose, you know, I would write entire stories that didn't have any dialogue in them because I didn't have a lot of confidence in my dialogue. So it's one of the things that I still feel like I'm a little self-conscious about, and I spend a lot of time on in terms of editing and trying to fine-tune it, but also really make everything accessible to a new reader. You know, for me, being somebody who didn't start reading comics until I was in my late 20s, like I was saying, when I was walking into a comic book shop, you know, it was X-Men number 972 and Superman number 3000. You know what I mean? It was very daunting to try to pick up these mythologies and read them. And so for me, whether it's X-O Man of War, Green Lantern, or Flash, and there's differing degrees of difficulty with those, I try to make every issue accessible in terms of a reader being able to pick it up and know what's going on, but also not have it be expository. And I think that's something that I'm still trying to work on a lot as I, you know, I don't even think I'm 50 issues in to writing monthly comics at this point. You know, XO 25 is coming out. Yeah, I'm probably in around 40 issues of comics I've written, I guess, by now.
Well, actually, I was thinking about that because, I mean, you were pretty green when we talked to you last time. You know, just,
sure.
Yeah, you know. And what do you know about storytelling within the comic book world? What do you know now that you didn't know then in this last year, in this last 10 and a half months since we've talked? What have you understood? Because you had mentioned before that Warren Simmons kind of took you and taught you how to tell monthly serial. He really was very influential in letting you understand the dynamics of it. And so has he continued to work with you? Now you've worked with other editors, other companies, and what do you know and what are you still learning about?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Warren Simons, you know, we're still on the phone all the time. I just talked to him earlier today, you know, and, you know, he really...
Did I call him Simmons? Simons, my mistake.
That's okay. Yeah. He really impressed upon me the need to make every issue accessible and explain to me in very concrete ways when I was first writing the early issues of X-O Man of War. You know, number one, I knew had to be accessible. You're telling the beginning of the story, it's kind of accessible by default. But number two, number three, in terms of how you enter the issue and in terms of how you transition into scenes and things like that, you know, he really worked with me a lot of those kinds of things. And there's certainly skills that I try to bring over to the other books that I work on, but really it's just not even just different editors, but different companies want different things, you know? And so it's just, and that's not in a bad way. It's just a different, you know, different philosophies and ways of doing things. I mean, with Green Lantern, I definitely would say that I've learned how to, coordinate across multiple titles, which is something that I never had to do before, you know, and that's a lot of moving pieces there. And I don't just try to write my story and say, hey, everybody, you know, react to that. You know, like I really try to to come up with big moments and big beats that will go across all the stories. And last time we talked, if it was 10 and a half months ago, I don't think Lights Out would have been out
yet. No, we had just not. Okay. Your first issue had been out.
Okay, so we can talk about that then in terms of that. You know, when I plotted out Lights Out, which was the five-issue crossover, it was a conscious choice to have Oa blow up in Green Lantern Corps and to have in that issue Hal retreat with all of the Corps while John stays behind and has the Battle of the Alamo basically while everybody retreats, because this is now John's issue of comics. And so I want there to be a big moment here. You know, it was a conscious decision to make Kyle Rayner the guy who at the end was going to pass through the source wall and replenish the reservoir. So I'm giving a big beat to New Guardians, and it's not like Hal is doing everything all the time. You know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I try to think about that in terms of, you know, what I do with Green Lantern, which is a book that DC very much wants to be linked with other books a lot. You know what I mean? We're moving into the Uprising storyline right now with Green Lantern Corps, so we're going to be doing a storyline there. Red Lanterns and Green Lanterns crossed over for an issue where we did a flip book. And so it's kind of the mission statement right now for Green Lantern that they want these books to be tied together and to be interacting with each other. So I think that skill set that I learned there, then I took over to Armor Hunters to try to now do this, you know, 18-part crossover that spans five titles now instead of just – over 3 months instead of, you know, five titles in 1 month. And so, you know, you pick up things as you go. There's obviously still that I have a lot to learn, and you know, the worst moment is always the day that the issue comes from the printer and I get my comps on my doorstep and I sit down and I read it and you see all the stuff that you did wrong and you wish you could still change, but it's in print now and so it's done, you know. But you use that lesson for next time.
You know, you mentioned 18 parts. I mean, I'm usually somebody who reads digitally nowadays, but I can't wait to get the interlocking covers. I can't wait to get the physical issues. And I mean, absolutely, Valiant is throwing their marketing genius behind this. I mean, they're going for it with this crossover.
Yeah, I love working with Valiant. You know, there's just a real scrappiness to them. You know what I mean? And there's just a real spontaneity to the way they do a lot of things. Including stories, you know, Armor Hunters, you know, I've written a couple of drafts that we just tossed out and started over from scratch, you know what I mean? And so, but in terms of marketing and everything, they're like a speedboat, you know, they're not a battleship. They can turn on a dime and they can adjust to things. And there's just, like I say, there's sort of a spontaneity in everything that they do. You walk into their office, you can just feel the energy. It's like they have this motto there that no idea is too stupid. If anybody has an idea, and I don't just mean in terms of stories, but in terms of how to market a book or whatever, you know, just spit it out. You know, we want to hear them all. And it's really kind of a fun place to work in that regard. You know,
and, it also seems like from the outside, it seems like they create a real family atmosphere, you know?
Yeah. I think that comes, in part from them being a smaller company. You know, I come, you know, originally from Top Shelf where I worked all those years. Giant is very much like a Top Shelf company. Just on a, you know, doing mainstream style of books, you know. But at DC, you know, DC is a larger company and it's a larger, you know, stable of titles. They've got 52 books. But in terms of where I work in the Green Lantern Group, we're also a family, you know. Right. I mean, me and Charles and Justin and Cullen and Van and the editors, you know, Matt Idelson and it was Chris Conroy, but now it's Darren Shan. You know, we all talk all the time. We all joke with each other. We get together. We hang out. So there's a real family environment over there as well, which is great. You know, you want to be able to have that kind of feeling that you sit down in the writer's room and there's no egos and we're all just in the foxhole together kind of thing, you know.
So Armor Hunters is going to be obviously a really big one for you. And I mean, last time, like, you've now written the Green Lantern crossovers, but this will be one of the first company-wide crossovers, company-wide crossover. So what's that like to deal with?
Yeah, it's not completely company-wide. You know, Valiant's Publishing, off the top of my head, I want to say they're doing 8 to 10, nine with Rye maybe, books a month. And so Armor Hunters is going to cross over into EXO, Unity, Bloodshot, and Harbinger. So with the main event series, it'll be five titles total. But it is over the span of 3 months or 4 months. So it's 18 parts, and it is a lot of moving machinery. And I think the thing is just trying to make sure there's enough for everybody to do. You know what I mean? 18 issues is a lot of space, and we have a really big story, but it is complicated in terms of moving all the pieces around and making sure that they're all where they need to be. But, you know, the editors help out a lot with that, and I read all the scripts from all the other people just to make sure that we're all, you know, in the same place and where we need to be. And then I'm also doing what they need me to do so that a character can be there where they need it to be for their issue, and then, you know, those kinds of things. So it's just a coordination with all those people. But, you know, I've known Matt Kent for a super long time. He was one of the first creators Top Shelf ever published. And so back when I was working at Top Shelf in their mailroom, Matt's books were there, and I used to see Matt at all the conventions and unbox his books for him and things. So I've known him probably 10 years. I've been working with Josh Dysart, obviously, for quite a while since we've been in Valiant together. Joe Harris is doing the Bloodshot book, so I don't know him real well yet, but, you know, I've read his scripts, and he's a super sharp guy and a really good writer, so it's a good group.
So I'll ask, because, you know, crossovers always are kind of a hot button issue in comic books, because, I mean, everybody loves crossovers, and they definitely hype the sales, but my big question is, do you write it to make sure that every single issue, including the crossover issues, really tie in and you kind of have to get the whole thing? Or do you write it so that you can read the main body, just the main four-issue miniseries, and still get the story?
I think it depends on the story. Armor Hunters is very much going to be the former. Like, we're working really hard to make each series stand on its own. Even the event miniseries stand separately, you know? But something with, like, Lights Out, it was designed and sort of the mission statement I was given when I pitched for the book was to come up with a storyline that would go from book to book to book for a month. You know what I mean? So and then end with the annual. So I think it just depends on the story and you know, what the parameters are as set down by the publisher. I don't necessarily have a preference for one over the other. You know, actually, I like the fact that I've done them two different ways now, because I'm always trying to do something different, you know, with every story that I do, so I can challenge myself and try out new things. So, you know, it just depends on what the job calls for, I guess. A lot of those determinations are made, you know, by me. It's sort of, you know, in a work for hire situation, the publisher is saying, this is what we want. We want a concept that will fit, you know, this publishing schedule for X amount of time, that will go across X amount of issues and like that, you know.
So last time we talked again, you mentioned, we talked to you about if there was any other characters within Valiant that you had wanted, and you said, you know, the character I really loved was Rye. And then, yeah. Of course, I was right before getting on board here with you, I was reading Rye, and I think both of us actually individually read it, and of course Matt Kent put it out now, and it's brilliant, so we're really lucky he got it. but no, you know, he got this book now. Now, what would your take have been? What would have been your Rye? Because we've seen what his is now.
Oh, wow. I don't know if I can say. I mean, I actually did a pitch for Rye, but that was way back a long time ago, and it was when they wanted Rye to be a very different thing. They didn't – there was some debate in the beginning about whether or not they wanted Rye to I don't know, man. I don't know if I can say.
Yeah. That's all right. We don't want to make you uncomfortable.
I don't know if I can say, because I don't know the total ins and outs of what they're doing now, and it may still apply.
Oh, okay.
You know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know if I can answer. But next time I come on, I'll be able to answer that question, because I suspect I will know the answer to this very soon.
Oh, okay.
And I'll be able to answer that question. But I think that what they wanted Rye to be back when they were talking to me about it was a different thing. Mm-hmm. It's still similar, you know, in some ways, but vastly different in other ways. And so my pitch was very different from what it seems to me Matt is doing on the page. And it is great. I loved it.
Oh, it's tremendous. Tremendous. And, you know,
I enjoyed reading a lot.
I mean, I was wondering how they were going to do a Rye, because, I mean, the Rye from the Valiant original universe, certainly, I mean, not just Bloodshot, but Magnus and these characters that are no longer around, they tied in. So I was wondering what the universe would be like, and I really like with what he's done there.
Yeah, no, I never had any doubt with that, because, I mean, it's the same thing with the Valiant universe as a whole. I mean, Solar was a big part of the original Valiant universe, and, you know, I had to have somebody explain to me why he was so necessary in the old Valiant universe, because he's apparently not in the new Valiant universe.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, kind of not
so,
there.
I mean, because I've never read those books, but when somebody was explaining to me how he was the linchpin of the original universe, I was like, well, you know, why and how? Because obviously... you know, it wasn't that much of a linchpin. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to do what we're doing, you know. So, you know, I had full faith in Matt that he'd be able to come up with something pretty crazy and you know, even without things like Magnus.
Though you should read the Solar issues by Shooter and Barry Windsor-Smith, because as comic books, they're amazing.
Yeah, it's honestly, I mean, that the original Valiant launch, I mean, I love what Valiant has done this time, but certainly the original Valiant launch for a uniform universe that everything was plotted out, and you'll appreciate this, sure, since you plot out so you know, far ahead of time. Every single panel meant something to another panel in another book, and but that Barry Windsor-Smith Jim Shooter really is a remarkable read.
Okay.
Yeah. So there you go. I'm sure Dinesh can get it to you. But speaking of remarkable reads, let's get over to your Flash.
Okay.
I mean, obviously, there's been changes. We've seen Wally West and
sure,
you know, physical changes, obviously, and that's, mm-hmm, that's been something that I'm not. For me, that's inconsequential. To me, it's more about the character. It's the person to be the same. So I think that's what I'm curious about. How will the person that Wally West is, how is his personality going to be similar to the personality before? Is it going to be a new person?
No, I think there are definitely going to be similarities. And I think that, you know, people have really latched on to what's different about the character, I think, you know, in terms of now the character, as we introduced him, in case any of your audience isn't familiar, Wally West was originally, I guess last time we saw him, pre-New 52, however long ago that was, you know, but he was, you know, in his 30s or what have you, and he was a white guy with red hair, and we've reintroduced him into the New 52 for the first time, and he's now a 12-year-old biracial youth. So he is the niece of Iris West, and the West family is Caucasian, and then his mother's side is African American, and he's biracial. And so I think a lot of people have latched on to that difference, and I understand that, because the last time they saw Wally, it was different, and I think a lot of people feel like they've taken a really long journey with Wally. They're really invested in the character and his history, and now for him to be 12 years old again, you know, to be biracial, I think for them it's like, well, you know, what happened to all that stuff that I read and those kinds of things. But for me, when DC came to us about reintroducing the character, and, you know, that's not the sort of thing that I would presume that I would be able to do, right? When they come and ask me, hey, pitch on the Flash, I wouldn't say, oh, well, all right, but I want to reintroduce Wally West. You know what I mean? It's their toy box. You know what I mean? They tell you what toys you can play with. They told me they wanted to reintroduce Wally West, and they had two stipulations, that he would be young and that he'd be biracial. To me, I actually thought that was great, you know, because reading comics and starting, like I was saying, in my late 20s, it's pretty glaringly skewed towards, you know, one demographic, you know, and
that's not the real
that
world.
Always was something that stood out to me, you know, it was always something that stood out to me as I was trying to familiarize myself with universes, not DC, but comics in general, you know, so I'm trying to familiarize myself with universes. And so, to me, the elements of Wally, the make Wally Wally, in terms of character, but even more so, is the journey that he took, right? I think what has made Wally so iconic is he was that guy who started out as a kid and then grew up to inherit the mantle and become the hero himself, you know, and that's this tremendous journey that he took that readers watched him take, and I think that's a large part of why they're so attached to him. I also think he had a very fiery personality. He also, especially in the Mark Waid run, he was a great romantic in a lot of ways. You know what I mean? There was a lot of really admirable qualities about him. I don't think that any of the changes that we've made to the character preclude him from being any of those things still.
Agreed.
You know? So I think that what we've done is we've introduced the character, and again, spoilers, you know, but the first time you see Wally West is in Flash issue 30. And all he is a dead body on the ground. That's it. You're set 5 years into the future, and he's a dead body on the ground. He doesn't say anything. He doesn't do anything. He doesn't move. He doesn't whatever. Any thought you have about him at that point is based purely on his physical appearance. That's it, right? Because that's all you get. Just look at him. So in Flash 30, we now go back to the present, and you meet him for the first time. And he is a 12-year-old kid whose father left when he was younger. And so he is being raised by his single mother. And they live in Central City, which was the focus of Forever Evil, one of the big sort of ground zero points of Forever Evil. And so the city has been destroyed. And in the midst of all that turmoil, his mother has gone missing and he doesn't know what's happened to her. It's almost like a post-Katrina sort of circumstance where there's so much destruction and there's so many bodies that they don't even know who's who and where's where, you know? And so that's the circumstance under which we meet him for the first time. And he, like a lot of people in Central City, kind of blames Barry a little bit for that. Blames the Flash, I would say, not Barry, because he doesn't know Barry is the Flash, but blames the Flash for that, because where was the Flash? Where were all the heroes when the crime syndicate came through in front of Evil and steamrolled the planet? Like, where was everybody, you know? There's a lot of people a little miffed about that, and he's certainly not one of them. And I think people have read the Flash Annual, and the first time you meet him, he's spray painting a symbol on the wall. It's like the Flash logo with a line through it. And a lot of people have latched onto this idea that he's anti-authority or whatever. And I think what you come to find out is he just has a bone to pick with the Flash because his mom is gone and his dad is gone. And I think other people, too, have sort of responded where, oh, you know, he's a biracial kid and his dad is gone and he's raised by a single mother and he needs a white guy to come help him out or whatever, you know, and they've sort of looked at it from that perspective. I find that very interesting because Barry Allen has a father who's in prison for murdering his own mother, and Captain Fry was to Barry what now potentially Barry can be to Wally. So to me, it's a very natural thing that this character would do, Barry, starting out in these extreme home circumstances that he started out with, and Captain Fry took him under his wing and raised him up. Why wouldn't he have that same impulse to help another kid who was, they would be able to relate to each other in that regard, I guess I'm saying. And I think a lot of people too, they only think about how Barry is going to affect Wally. But I can tell you, as someone who's a parent, and I have two kids of my own, the child affects the adult as much as the adult affects the child. You know, in some ways, children are role models for parents almost, if that makes any sense, you know? So this is going to be very much a dynamic that goes both ways. And we're going to see how Barry affects Wally, but also how Wally affects Barry and the Flash as well.
It's interesting because when I think about how little you read comics before, like how much, knowing that some of the changes that were going to be made to Wally, how much research did you do into the original Wally West character?
Pretty good amount. I mean, obviously it's a very long, it's not 72 issues like X-Man of War was, you know what I mean? But so I'm still working my way through some things. But yeah, I mean, I definitely familiarized myself with a lot of it. I really enjoyed the Mark Waid run, what I've read of that so far. I felt it was really outstanding stuff. You know, I read a lot of the early, like, you know, Silver Age stuff, you know. You know, so yeah, I've read a fair amount of it, but still more to do. And you know, as I'm working on the character, I continue to read that stuff. And it's just like Green Lantern. I'm still working my way through a lot of the old Green Lantern stuff as well. I mean, I've read the whole Geoff Johns era, but I'm going back and I'm reading some of the Engelhardt stuff, or going back and reading the Green Lantern omnibuses, the old Silver Age things, and all that kind of stuff.
Did you get through the Kerry Bates, Carmen Infantino Trial of the Flash era? Have you read that yet?
I have not. It's sitting right here,
though. Is it? I can't wait to hear what you think of that. Because, boy, yeah. I love that. I love that storyline. So you've had a chance to read some of the Engelhardt, huh? Have you come across a character called Goldface yet?
I have come across Goldface, yes.
Yeah, yeah. What do you think? Is it a great character or what?
Actually, as goofy as it sounds, and this goes back to the Silver Age, too, but he popped up in the Engelhardt stuff, too, as well, in the I don't know how to even say the guy's name, you know, Ubik, Dr. Ubix or whatever, you know. But I actually have a pretty interesting take, I think, on Sonar that I would like to get to someday. But who knows if we'll ever get around to it.
Yeah, just glossing over the, glossing over the white elephant on the moon. If you want, right here, right now, you and I can plot the comeback.
We can work out the Goldface story right now.
Let's just say creative geniuses.
You know what I should have done? Like, I should have had him in the science cells. And then that Green Lantern Corps issue, and Green Lantern Corps in the middle lights out, they had to open up the science cells and let all the prisoners out. I should have, like, let them out and just let them die in the vacuum of space.
But you know what, though? If you had had him in there, then Mo here would
have made his day, wouldn't it?
It would have made his day, but he also would have, awesome. Like, you couldn't live near the guy because it would have been like, yeah, I got Rob Venditti to add Goldface to
Had to kill him.
Had to kill him.
I would say Goldface and Evil Star are the two that people mention the most.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Nice, nice. You know, one of the things actually I noticed about your Green Lantern is I've really appreciated how you have instilled the qualities in each of the core into that person with the ring, you know. So Hal Jordan, he is very headstrong and willful, and and you know Carol Ferris is very loving. You're seeing that side of her, and is that a very conscious decision?
Yeah, I mean, particularly with Hal, you know, when we talked last time, my first issue was out. I have no doubt that I probably said to you guys I was telling a risky story and those kinds of things.
That's it.
You know, I think now that we're about a year into it, you know, we can see what that story was. And in a lot of ways, it was me looking at this character who, one, is chosen based on his willpower, right? That's number one. Number two, he's the best of them all. So sensibly, he is the most willful of all of the of the entire universe.
Doesn't make him the best leader necessarily, does it?
This is the most willful dude in the entire universe, right? On top of that, he's a guy who's got a very sort of gut instinct, Russian mentality, because he's a test pilot by trade. And that's a very reflexive business to be in, right? You don't sit there and think, maybe I do this, maybe I do that, because by then you've crashed into the ground. So he does everything by gut instinct, and everything he does always works out in his favor, to the point that he even has beaten death. Like, he's beaten death
multiple times,
right?
I think.
Right. So you take that guy and you now make him leader of an organization. I think he's probably going to screw up a few times, and it's going to take him a while to figure out that everything isn't right by virtue of the fact that he thought of it, you know? Because his track record has done nothing but to reinforce the mentality that he's had all the way up to this point, and he's already super dug in because he's the most willful guy in the whole universe, right? So I would say that, you know, when you look at it from that perspective, he did have some stumbles, but he's now trying to reconcile this willful nature that he has with having to be a leader in a more formal sense. He's always been a leader because he's a very charismatic guy, and where he goes, people follow. That's different from being, you know, the quarterback of the team and having to, you know, call the plays and read the defense and all this kind of stuff. You know, sorry, as a football metaphor for you Canadians up there.
Please,
I don't know what the equivalent of that would be in hockey,
us,
but you can sub that
football.
In. If you
for
want.
The two of us.
Yeah, yeah.
It's still.
Canada has its own football league, and
which is
great. So you can make a football reference, and we'll get.
Okay. Well, not only that, but we play about 15 fantasy football leagues a year, and that's only the NFL. CFL is only 8 teams. So
sure. So yeah, so that's the transition and the growth as a character that Hal is having to go through, and you know, I've been enjoying it. I've been enjoying writing that journey with him, and I think going into Uprising now, where he now is sort of grown into this leadership role, but now he has a war brewing against a lot of people in the universe that want to sort of throw off the from their perspective the yoke of the Green Lantern Corps.
You pissed a lot of people off over the years.
I'm sorry?
The Green Lantern Corps pissed a lot of people off over the years.
Yeah, not even all of it's Hal's fault, right?
No.
I mean, you've got the Manhunters, you've got you know, Krona, you've got Rise of the Third Army, Wrath of the First Lantern. Now the revelation and lights out that the energy they use is actually, you know, the energy of creation, you know. So they've sort of fallen out of favor. And Hal's the guy who ends up being in leadership chair when all this stuff comes to a head. And now he not only has to find a way to win this war, because even though maybe some in the universe view the core as villains, we as readers know they're heroes. But he has to find a way to reclaim that reputation. That's going to be the big culmination of sort of this first year that I've been on the book.
So the last time we talked, we were talking about when you felt like the character kind of gained your voice. And you said that issue 23 was the one for Green Lantern. So I'm wondering, firstly, if you've got kind of, if that has kind of changed and adapted as you've grown in Green Lantern, but also with The Flash, like, have you written the issue now that is your voice, like your true voice of The Flash?
Well, issue number 32 of The Flash, the 10 pages that I wrote for that are probably some of my favorite 10 pages of comics I've ever written, ever, you know? That doesn't mean I can be everybody else's favorite, right? Like, I really love the Relic issue that I did for Villains Month. I was really proud of that issue. But I think that some people didn't know what to make of it. You know what I mean? The 20 splash pages and all those kinds of things.
Rags
but,
Morales
yeah,
killed it on that.
I'm sorry?
Rags Morales, he killed it on that. I mean, just
yeah, he absolutely did. And that was actually DC again. They said, we want you to do this Villains Month issue for this character Relic that you've created for Lights Out. And we want you to tell the whole story in 20 splash pages because we're going to use them all as variant covers. In advance.
Wow.
Which I've never done a story like that before, but to me it was like, I'm going to get to create an entire universe and blow it up in 20 panels. You know what I mean? Like,
I mean, who has done that before?
Nobody will ever ask me to do that ever again, you know? And so to me, I was very much excited about doing that. And again, I didn't use any thought captions, right? I used the narrative captions, but I didn't use any thought captions in that. But so yeah, you know, issue 32 for The Flash is one where I really am very, very proud of the two scenes. Yeah, I wrote two scenes, but they're both pretty long scenes in that issue. One is Barry, you know, the future version of Barry, and the other one is Barry and Wally in the modern day. And I'm really, really proud of those. As far as Green Lantern, yeah, the reason why I said that about 23, which I didn't tell you at the time, is because there was a scene in 23 where there's this escaped prisoner that Hal wants to go track down and all the rings aren't working. And Kilowog is sort of, you know, saying, hey, look, you know, we don't even know what the rings are doing right now. You know, we can't, you shouldn't go out. But Hal, being Hal, he's the one who's going to go out. He's not going to send somebody else to go out because they might end up getting killed. Like, he's going to be the one that has to go into harm's way. That's Hal, right? Hal as a leader is always the guy to charge into harm's way before everybody else. And as a leader, you now have to choose who's got to go into harm's way, right? And that's something I think that Hal really has to struggle with, and we start to see that in 23. And so that was why I picked out that issue.
I love when John convinced him that he was the one to stay behind. I thought that was, you know, the way he did it.
Lights Out, you mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, very much so. Again, that's just Hal having to learn.
No, if somebody's staying behind,
what it means to be a leader. Yeah. You know, his job now is to lead everybody away. And assign somebody else to stay behind at the Alamo. And again, that was all intentional when I was plotting Lights Out, you know, that John would have that moment to have to explain that to Hal so that John has a big moment in his book.
Oh, you almost have John.
As opposed to John leading a retreat in Green Lantern Corps and Hal staying behind on Oa.
He's the voice of reason, you know, in many ways I see.
Yeah, very diametrically opposed. Like, I think if you're looking at two characters, I don't know what could be more different than a fighter pilot and a sniper, right? Like one guy is just like as fast as he can, gut reaction, whatever. The other guy's like laying on the hill for 3 weeks until he gets the headshot and then he's taking it. You know what I mean? Like, that's two diametrically opposed people. And so their leadership styles and their approaches to conflict resolution would both be vastly different. And I think we've certainly tried to play that up in terms of how we've written Green Lantern and how Van has written Green Lantern Corps. So,
I think the growth is what I'm enjoying most about Hal, just being able to kind of read through the issues. And I read through them, and caught up fairly quickly here. But I do enjoy the growth cycle that Hal is experiencing right now.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah. It's really going to come to a head, like I say, in this Uprising arc, which just started with 31 and is going to run through August. No, I'm sorry, July. It's going to run through July. So it's the May, June, July issues. And then in August, there's going to be another issue with another scene that I wrote with Hal and his brother that I also really enjoyed a lot.
You like the quiet moments, don't you?
I do, yeah. And it's hard to do with Green Lantern. You know, it's tough to do because it is a book that has to drive so many other books. And it is a book that has all this epic action. And it's hard to it's hard to get those quiet moments. But I think I'm finding newer and different ways to do it. It's much easier with something like The Flash. You know, and this goes back to what I was saying earlier about trying to make every issue an entry point. When you look at something like Green Lantern, it's a very complex mythology, and it's not intuitive, right, in the sense that he's called the Green Lantern, first of all, but he doesn't really use a lantern. He uses a ring, right? So right off the bat, like, the name doesn't even really add up. I mean, I know the lantern is his battery, but that's not what you see him fighting with or whatever, you know what I mean? Then there's the emotional spectrum, and it's like green is willpower and red is rage and, you know, violet is love and all these kinds of things. That's not an intuitive concept, right? That's pretty complicated mythology. If somebody was a new reader like myself walking into a store to have to try to get everybody up to speed on every issue as opposed to the Flash. He's a guy with a lightning bolt on his chest and he runs fast. He's called the Flash. You know what I mean? Like, you get that. You could see him and see his name and be like, the Flash. Oh, he's a guy who runs fast, you know, because it's just intuitive. There's something very innate about the desire to run fast, and it's something we all want to do, you know, is, you know, your kids, you know, from the moment they're born, they just want to move faster and faster and faster. You know, they don't want to shoot webs out of their hands or, you know, have a ring that makes constructs out of light, right? Their brains can't even conceive of those concepts, but running fast is just intuitive. It's instinctual. And so Flash is much easier in that regard.
But children can be very willful.
They absolutely
in their
can.
Own way. Yes. But now, thinking about Relic and the way that you created him, he's a villain, but he definitely has a lot of core elements that kind of make you kind of care for him and respect his sure. ideals.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Brett, because that's actually one of the things that I've noticed in all your work. I mean, you really do present the villain should always believe at his core he's correct, right? That he's the mm-hmm. good guy. And that's something that I really appreciate about your writing and that I've seen, not just with Relic, but with other characters as well.
Yeah, you know, I'll thank you both for pointing that out. But especially the second part about, you know, drawing that parallel across all my work. You're the first person to ever really say that. A lot of people say...
I was just going to say that.
You're welcome.
A lot of people will say it about one book or they'll say it about another book, but nobody's ever really, I don't know, maybe everybody I talk to only reads one of my books.
I read everything. But, I read everything you've ever written.
Yeah, that's true.
But no, that's very true. That's true. I think that, you know, I think there's a real tendency to make heroes into anti-villains, you know? And I'm not interested in doing that, but I am interested in making heroes into anti-heroes. I'm not interested in doing that, but I am interested in making my villains anti-villains. You know what I'm trying to say? Like, I don't try to villain down my heroes. I try to hero up my villains. And so really the way to do that is just to show things from their perspective and you know, make them relatable so that even if their methods are abhorrent, you can at least understand what it is they're trying to do. And Relic was very much that kind of character. The Vine and Exo Man of War are intended to be that kind of character. I would think the Armor Hunters are that kind of character. The Prophet from the Surrogates, Steeplejack, those are those kind of characters. The Senator and the Homeland Directive, you know. So, yeah, very much so. And again, I think a large part of it is just having those scenes where the hero isn't in it, but the villain is, you know what I mean? Like just showing things from their perspective, like the Relic issue, right? It was a whole issue about just this guy and how it wasn't in it anywhere. And it allowed you to really understand who this character was and why he was doing what he was doing. And in some ways he was right, right? His theory was right. And so what the story then ends up becoming about, and the reason why I do that with villains and heroes and make everybody sympathetic is because I try to talk about things in my stories that, one of the ways you can make something new reader friendly is to give people something to latch onto, right? Like how can they take this story about, you know, an emotional spectrum and seven different core in outer space who all wield weapons based on emotions and constructs of light and couch that in an idea that is grounded and relatable, right? And so for me, it was the idea of consumption. Like where does that energy come from? What would happen if that was a finite source? And then how do you determine when it's okay to use that and when you don't? I don't know the answer to that question myself, right? Like, how do we justify, you know, driving our cars but, you know, not using coal or whatever? You know what I mean? Like, it's a discussion that we all have to have with ourselves, you know? Like, what do we take from this world and how do we justify our taking of it? You know what I mean? And so to me, that's what that Lights Out story and what the core is still dealing with a little bit now is all about. You know, like existence is consumption. You know, we breathe air, we eat food, we build our houses on plots of land out of materials, you know, from fallen trees that we cut down and so on and so forth. So the books that I write are printed on trees. You know what I mean? So like, how do we justify that consumption? And so that was sort of that theme that I wanted to work with. And the reason why the villains become sympathetic is because they're questions that I don't know the answer to. Like if I knew already, you know, if you were to read a book like The Surrogates and I knew already that this technology is totally awesome and we should all be machines and live in, and live like robots and that would be great and it would be Shangri-La, then that book would be very preachy because I would my villain would probably feel very stale and mustache twirly because I wasn't really relating to my own villain. And as a reader, you'd be, we all know what it feels like when you watch a movie or a TV show, read a book, and you can tell what the writer thinks because they're beating you over the head with it, right? And their villains suck because it isn't even like they have the energy to put into the villain because they don't even believe what the villain is trying to do. You know what I mean? And so to me, that's why I don't ever try to write those kinds of stories where I already know in my head what the answer is, because then I think it would be preachy and it would just be stale. And so maybe it's that drive to try to broach these questions that I myself am grappling with that lead to the villains being more sympathetic, because it's almost like the hero and the villain are debating this out on the page.
Yeah, because that was one thing I really liked about the Relic story, just at the end of the 23.1, I think it was, where you realize that he was a villain by the fact that he was just like, well, I obviously can't convince you of this, so the only way that I can do it is to actually just try to stop you physically.
Yeah, yeah. Which is villainous, right? Yeah, I mean, like, if you come from a prior universe and it didn't work out, like, and there's a whole new universe, you might want to try talking again, you know? But you can also understand from his perspective, like, no, the stakes are too high. Like, I tried that, and it didn't work, so now I'm going to do it this way, you know? And if you guys don't want to get on board with that, well, then I'm just going to have to take you all out, you know? But I think that idea of consumption, again, this is part of what Uprising is going to be about. And you know, what do we all do in our daily lives? How do we justify our own existence and the resources we consume? Do we consume those resources and endeavor to do right by others and leave the world better than we entered it, or at least as good as we can? Or do we endeavor to just consume for the sake of consumption and do wrong and leave the world worse off? You know, I think that's something that every single one of us in our lives, when we have to decide what kind of person we're going to be, that's a question we all have to ask.
Well, I have so many places, so many things I want to bring up here. It's unbelievable. Where should I go with this? How much longer are we going to go here?
It doesn't matter. You know, it's fine. I'm with you. I'm on your time. So.
You know, at the end of Lights Out, that's where I personally feel. I mean, Green Lantern, just because Geoff Johns had been there for so long, I mean, he cast such a large shadow. I felt by the time that you had finished that storyline that you'd thrown all that off. This was it. Because it was a different dynamic. I mean, now the OA is destroyed, and, you know, the Blue Lanterns are essentially gone. And by that point, I felt, okay, this is now it's your playground. Instead of you've taken the toys from somebody else's playground, and you put them in your own now.
Yeah, you know, and a lot of those things, it wasn't like it was all designed for shock value. And I sat down in the beginning and was like, all right, what can I do to just really catch people's attention? Like, to me, I was reading this story and as I'm plotting out in my head, I'm a very sort of organized, methodical writer, which I think could be a detriment to me. You know, like some guys are very stream of consciousness and I think there's a real spontaneity to what they do that comes across in the page. I don't have that. You know, we each write with what we got, you know what I mean? So for me, as I was plotting out the story, if this guy comes into our universe and he's going to go and pick off the core one by one, he's going to go after the Blue Lanterns first because they're the ones that can supercharge other rings and consume the most amount of energy. So they would be first on his hit list. I love Saint Walker. You know, I love Worth. I love all those guys, but that's what the story said would probably happen. And so now you're faced with the question, am I going to let the story do that? Or am I going to not let it happen because I like those characters and then try to do something which to me I would worry would feel artificial? Same thing with Oa blowing up. When I got to that point in the story and I knew he was going to blow up the battery, and we've seen in earlier stories these catacombs underneath and the energy sort of being inside the planet and all that, it's like, well, that would do a lot of serious damage to the planet. And if the planet went up, like, what would happen then? And it was like, they would go to Mogo. And then in my head, I was like, why aren't they already on Mogo? You know, it's a mobile planet with Green Lantern powers. Like, why aren't they already there, you know? And so to me, Mogo also is one of the most unique characters, not even in the DC universe, but in comics in general. It's a very, very unique character. And unique characters are really hard to come by, right? Because there's a lot of tropes that get repeated, and there's, you know, there's the Flash, and there's Quicksilver, and there's, you know,
Namor, Aquaman. Yeah. Those,
I'm sorry. Yeah. Namor and Aquaman. There's, you know, Superman and Superboy and Supergirl, you know, it's, you know, there's Hal and Jon Stewart and Kyle Rayner and Guy Gardner. You know what I mean? So Mogo is Mogo, and there's just one Mogo. And so to me, when I saw an opportunity to bring Mogo into the series in a way that was organic and develop naturally within the story, it was just like, this is something we have to do, because it brings in this unique character, and it also expands the power set and the mission statement of the core really in a way that we've never seen before. Like, Mogo can now move to the heart of the war zone and go sit there, as opposed to having to base everything from the center of the universe. And so the conversations with Mogo and St. Walker is something that I've really had a lot of fun with, and it all is going somewhere. You know, there's a long tail plan for all these kinds of things, and what's going to happen with St. Walker and the issue of the reservoir and how that is ultimately resolved. I mean, I know what all these answers are. It's just a matter of getting around to doing them, you know?
How do you, if you get inspiration on one series, but you're supposed to write something else, you have a deadline for something else, or does that occur when you're like, oh man, I just really want to write this book, or I have an idea, this is where my focus is, but I need to work on this other thing. How do you kind of work around that?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. Maybe it's because of just my nature, like I say, being pretty organized and methodical, but I tend to do like this issue, like this week right now, I'm working on Armor Hunters, you know? So this week I'm writing an issue of Armor Hunters, and that's kind of where all my focus is. And then once that issue is done, then I'll move on to the next thing and all my focus will be there. And once in a while, I'll be driving around in a car and something will hit me about another book or whatever, and I'll just file it away or jot it down and then I'll get to it. But I don't stop what I'm doing and go write the other thing. Like, I can't write two pages of this and one page of that, and three pages of that. Like, I got to write this issue, and then I got to go write that issue, and then I got to go write that issue. And that's just kind of the way that I'm wired.
Now, we heard a story about James Cameron and when he was making one of his movies, Aliens, in fact, and that he had three desks, and he had a different script going in each desk, and just the different things on each desk as well. So perhaps is it that you just don't have enough desks?
I think the problem is I don't have a house big enough for three desks is what it is.
Yeah, because maybe it's just that you need the different space, and you get your head space into a different room.
Yeah, we're listening to the cast of Aliens. They're talking about how he'd walk in and see him writing on one desk, say something to them, stand up, go over to the other desk, start writing. And you're like, really?
I can't even imagine that. That doesn't even make any sense to me, you know? But, I mean, God bless him. Obviously, he makes good movies, you know? But, I mean, I don't even know how that would work, you know?
It's insane, yeah. Actually, I can't fathom that either. There's so much I want to ask you. Let's look at this. I mean, we've talked before about how you didn't get into comics till you were, you know, you said your late 20s. So when you're growing up, what are your favorite cartoons, movies, TV shows, books? What are the things that when you're a teenager or a child, both, that are kind of the things that were what Robert Venditti was into?
When I was real little, elementary school age, you know, I was all about Bugs Bunny and Tom and Jerry.
Nice.
You know, still to this day, I'll watch that stuff if it's on TV. There's just a real intelligence to it, you know. But to me, there was no higher ambition than to be an animator, than to draw Bugs Bunny cartoons. Like, that was my life goal, you know. I used to draw a lot. I'm sorry.
It's like you're a failure.
I am a failure, yeah. Which I think is actually, I think that's great, actually, you know. I'm a failed artist. You know what I mean? Like, I sucked at it. Even at a young age, I knew I was no good at it. Mm-hmm. I would try to draw, and I had the animation books and the colored pencils, and I'd work very hard at it, but I could just tell I didn't have it, you know. And so I think I started writing because it was a way for me to describe in words what I couldn't draw with my hand, you know. When I got to be older, like high school, you know, I like Thundercats, Silverhawks, stuff like that. You know, like I actually watched the old Thundercats. They replayed it again recently on Cartoon Network, I think, and I watched it with my kids, and they liked it as well. You know, Transformers, all those kinds of things. But, you know, I don't know why I never read comics. It doesn't make any sense. You would think that I wanted to be an artist so bad that I would have been something that it would have done. My brother was reading comics, you know. He was reading Marvel stuff and DC stuff, and my older brother, but it just never was anything that I latched onto. We'd go to the store, and, you know, the grocery store would have the spinner racks outside, and my dad would buy my brother a bunch of things, and once in a while he'd give me like a Tarzan comic or something, and I still have those. I've got like 5 Tarzan comics, you know, because I like the old black and white Tarzan movies. And that was pretty much it, you know. And then for some reason, when I was older and I read my first comic, it dawned on me that here was a medium where I could write the words and somebody else could render it into the art that I'm incapable of doing. And that would be as close as I ever got to that original childhood ambition that I had. And so that was kind of what set me down that path.
You know, the things we're hearing you talk about, you know, Thundercats, Transformers, these are comic book type stories. These are comic book. So sure, these certainly are obviously an influence on you. What about movies? What were some of your favorite movies when you were younger?
Oh, man. Like, how old? Give me an age.
I don't know. Teenager.
Like, when I was a little kid, like, if we're talking, like, you know, animated movies when I was younger, Jungle Book, again, I was a Tarzan fan. The Rescuers was one of my favorites. Robin Hood was another one of my favorites. Yeah. These are all Disney ones I'm talking about. As I got to be older, like high school age, middle school age, I'm trying to think what I was watching around then. Like, I remember I had a buddy named Chris Legg when I was in sixth grade, and between the two of us, I think we watched Weird Science like 9 million times. Like, I just couldn't get enough of Weird Science.
Kelly LeBrock.
I'm trying to think. When I got into college, you know, like, I watched Blade Runner in college, and that blew my mind. I tried to watch it when I was younger, like, you know, fifth, sixth grade probably. And my stepmom was watching, and I was like, what is this? You know, this doesn't even make any sense. It's stupid, you know? But then I saw it in college. I was like, oh, wow, that's an awesome movie, you know? I can't even remember in high school. I used to go see all the Schwarzenegger movies and the Steven Seagal movies when they came out, you know, the Jean-Claude Van Damme movies. I would go see all those. I can't really remember much else.
What about the genres of books or authors? Series.
Yeah, middle school, and it's interesting because we were talking about horror earlier, but middle school and in early high school, I read Stephen King like nonstop. You know, I read all that stuff. But I reached an age where for some reason horror all of a sudden just got too scary for me. It was like I was too young to really understand how scary it probably was. And then when I got old enough, I was like, wow, that's scary. And it started to stick with me. And that's when I started reading it. So, yeah, I read a lot of Stephen King because my mom was always reading Stephen King, you know, and she was giving me Stephen King books to read when I was in like sixth or seventh grade or whatever. She was always encouraging me to read. What'd you say?
I wouldn't give a kid that age Stephen King.
Yeah, I mean, she didn't give me, like, she never gave me Pet Sematary, you know. Like, it was on her shelf and she's like, you don't want to read that one. And I was like, all right. And to this day, I've never read it, you know. But, like, what did she give me? She gave me The Stand, you know, Carrie. She didn't give me Carrie. Christine. One that my favorite one of all time is one that isn't even very horror, but is The Dead Zone. You know, that book just fascinated me. So, you know, she would give me those kinds of books. And I also read The Lord of the Rings when I was in seventh grade. The very first novel I ever read that was like a grown-up book was Watership Down. Mm. That would have been, I would say that was around maybe like fourth or fifth grade, maybe. Yeah.
Can I keep going here, bro?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Okay, so I say to you, comedy movie, what comes into your head? What do you say? What's the first thing that goes
comedy
to your mind?
Movie? Well, you know what? I was just talking to somebody about something about Mary today, so that's the one that leaped into my head. We were talking about how that movie just transformed what comedy movies were. You know, like, I don't think people knew comedy movies could be that until that movie came out. And now it's like all comedy movies are that, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, I mean, it was a real watershed moment. And I actually met the screenwriter at San Diego one year. He came by the Top Shelf booth when I was working there and I was talking to him, a super nice guy and super humble about it, you know? And, it was just like, he had this sense that when they were making the movie, they started to get the sense that they were really onto something, you know, and they had really kind of reinvented the wheel, and that's what it turned out to be.
Yeah, that's a movie that didn't start off that strong at the box office, just got better and better, and, you know,
yeah.
just made more money.
Huge legs. Some everybody's seen it at this point.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? Everybody quotes it. Yeah.
Okay, that's a war movie. What pops into your head?
Saving Private Ryan, I guess. Yeah.
Saving Private Ryan. Fantasy film.
Before I saw Saving Private Ryan, it probably would have been Midway, because I remember seeing Midway when I was younger, and that really stuck with me. But Saving Private Ryan, I saw in the theater, and it was tough. You know,
oh,
it was a hard watch. I've actually not seen the whole movie again all the way through. I always turn it off at the scene where the Jewish soldier is rolling around with the Nazi soldier, and the other guy is paralyzed on the steps. It's like, I cash out. I can't get through that part.
You know, I have the same reaction, you know, to Platoon. I mean, I remember watching that one time going, boy, am I glad I watched that. I never want to see that again. I don't want to go near it.
Yeah, yeah.
The best war movies are anti-war movies, right? So fantasy film, yeah. What pops in your head?
Yeah, you know, I've not really seen a lot of fantasy. I guess it would be the Lord of the Rings stuff. That's what jumps to mind. You know, I've never been a real big fantasy, other than Lord of the Rings, reader or anything like that. So I don't know a lot about those kinds of things.
No Conan? No Conan?
Yeah, I've seen Conan. Yeah, that didn't come to mind, but yeah, I've seen Conan.
That's all right.
I liked Conan.
Everybody's
sci-fi? Blade Runner. Yeah. Okay. Probably one of my – Blade Runner's one of the top five, you know.
Animation?
Animation, mm-hmm. You said?
Animated film?
Probably, like I was saying earlier, the ones I was mentioning, Rescuers would be what I would think of.
Yeah. Sports?
I haven't seen like a lot of anime and stuff like that, you know. I don't know why, not any particular reason. I just haven't.
Same as they reading comic books when you were younger. Just, yeah. It's
yeah,
there.
Somebody will. Yeah, you'll see a few and you'll be like, man, I should be watching this. Sports film.
Sports film. Hoosiers.
Hoosiers.
Yeah. I played basketball all through middle school and high school. Not just on the school teams, but I mean, that was my life. I just played basketball all the time. When I wasn't playing for the team at school, I was playing in another league, or I was playing in a park, playing pickup with my buddies. And Hoosiers is one of my favorite movies. The Natural would be another one that I'm a really big fan of.
Both great films. Great, great films. Yeah. The speech in the final game, or, you know, the Hoosiers is great. Gene Hackman's just great. So, I was going to mention one, and now I forgot, so that's okay. Maybe we can move on. Brett, go ahead.
So you didn't ask me Westerns.
What's that?
So I'll tell you.
Oh, yes, that's right, because you are a big fan of the Western genre, right?
Yeah, yeah. Unforgiven would be the first one I would think of if you asked me about Westerns.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay.
So would that factor into your Western storylines when you do your Western book finally?
No, it's completely different. Yeah, it's a completely different kind of Western. It would be almost like sort of a sci-fi Western-y kind of thing, you know? Post-apocalyptic Western, maybe.
Does Green Lantern have that kind of element to a certain degree of, like, you know, making Hal a Western-style gunslinger in a sci-fi world?
I think there's definitely moments, you know, where that hopefully comes through, you know? I think if you look at issues 25 and 26, when Hal goes to Nal Anja's homeworld and she's the leader of these outer clans, and there's a big gunfight on this, you know, that starts off in a saloon and it spills out into the street and the townsfolk are there. There's even a point where a woman is on a Green Lantern's head hitting him with a frying pan on the head. Do you know what I mean? So, yeah, I definitely try to channel some Western vibe and that kind of stuff. Okay. For her character specifically and you know, her clans, it's a very Western-based character.
Brains, yeah. I got it now. Documentary.
Documentary. Wow. I don't know, but I will say that the ESPN 30 for 30 movies that they did recently, there was a lot of those that I really enjoyed. There was one about the University of Miami. It was just called The U. I grew up in South Florida when all that stuff was going on, watching those games as a fan, like as middle school age. And then seeing that documentary, you're like, wow, those guys were jerks, you know? That was a really good one. I saw one the other day called You Don't Know Bo. It was about Bo Jackson. I like that one. What's the one about Len Bias? That was good. I like those a lot, yeah. Oh, you know what was a really good one? Was HBO did one that was called Magic and Larry, I think. It was all about Magic Johnson and Larry Bird. Interviewing them too, talking about each other and then going over their careers. And I grew up a Celtics fan. I mean, we didn't have basketball in South Florida when I was a kid, and my family's from Rhode Island, so I was a Celtics fan through my family. I hated the Lakers. I hated Magic Johnson. I hated all those guys. Watching this movie and seeing how they become such great friends, you know, they were such antagonists for each other. And it started out as this, you know, almost hatred for each other that grew into respect, that grew into like this very close bond because they were what got each other out of bed every day. You know what I mean? And just watching how their relationship transformed over the span of their careers, it was a really good movie.
All right. We both want to ask you a question here. Have you seen any of the HBO Legendary Nights? Do you see their Gaddy Ward or any of those?
Which movies?
HBO Legendary Nights. They would do their documentaries, this similar type of idea on that's a 30 for 30 there on the HBO's boxing Legendary Nights. They did a 90
minute. Okay, well, I don't know if that's what it was called, but I saw one about actually, I saw two. I don't know if they were HBO, so you can correct me if I'm wrong. One was about Sugar Ray Leonard and Hector Camacho.
Mm-hmm.
Was that who fought?
No, it wasn't
Camacho. Who was the guy the Panamanian fighter?
No Moss. Roberto Moran.
Yeah.
That was one of the Legendary Nights. Yeah, that was good.
Okay. And then the other one, I don't even remember the fight, but it was a boxer who got into a fight with an Irish kid who was like an up-and-coming Irish kid, and the boxer like did something to his gloves and like beat the Irish guy to a bloody pulp.
I don't know what that is.
That was definitely an HBO one, but I don't know if it was called Legendary Nights.
No. Well, you should look up Legendary Nights Gaddy Ward. I think you'd really appreciate that one. It's fascinating.
Okay.
If you're not familiar with it, it's even more fascinating.
Yeah, I'll check it out. But it's real sad what's happened to boxing. You know, I remember when I was a kid, boxing was on TV all the time, and when the Olympics were on, it was a marquee sport. You know, I mean, it was like swimming is now. You know, like boxing was always on in the Olympics. Now they don't even show boxing. Boxing's never on TV. You can't watch it without pay-per-view. I mean, you can a little bit, but it's not like when I was a kid when you could see the title fight. You know what I mean?
You knew the names of all the champions and all the weight classes at one point. Now,
it's tough.
And largely, they did it to themselves.
Yeah, it's kind of they killed themselves in a way, you know. But
all right, so you talk about the Magic Johnson Larry Bird rivalry slash, you know, friendship now, and how it was the two of them that made each other get out of bed in the morning. So who makes you get out of bed in the morning, besides your kids, that is?
Yeah, really, my kids.
Fred Van Lente. We know that, you know, he's a great writer, he's a great archer at Armstrong. You know, he told us that he didn't want us to piss you off. He said that your nickname is actually Robert Vendetta.
Yeah, so Vendetta, yes.
Yeah. The Vendetta.
He calls me that, yeah. No. For some reason, the Valiant fans all started calling me V Diddy. And so that's actually getting around now. Like, I have people review my book sometimes and they'll refer to me as V Diddy.
Now the name of the show.
I'm sorry, what's that? Yeah. As a writer, I don't know. As a writer, your biggest antagonist is yourself, I think. You know what I mean? It's always that. That battle of confidence against yourself, you know, you're always, at least for me, you're always your own worst critic. You know, nothing you ever do is ever perfect. Like I say, it comes from the printer and you read it and you see all the stuff you wish you did differently. And there's nobody out there that I see myself as competing with or anything like that. Certainly not, you know, I don't know, maybe it's just a different mentality, and maybe that's why I like writing, because it is different than basketball. You know, I used to go to play basketball and, you know, it was a real take no prisoners kind of mentality. And I was like a jerk on the court or whatever, but I was out there to win, and so were my buddies, and we played hard, and you know, that was just the way we played. And so, you know, writing is much more subdued, I would say, in that regard. You know, really, you're just, I don't know. You're the kind of writer that you are, I think, and it's hard. I'm always trying to get myself outside my comfort zone, but like I say earlier, you know, I admire like a spontaneous writer, like Jim Mahfood. I don't know if you know Jim Mahfood's work at all, but
yeah, it's great.
He does this book that this series, or I guess strip, if you want to call it, that he did for Heavy Metal. It was called Call the Cat That Makes Peanut Butter Sandwiches. Okay, the story is about a cat who makes the best peanut butter sandwiches in town. And the mafia is always trying to muscle him out of his peanut butter sandwich territory. And so he'll like go to a peanut butter sandwich delivery, and the mob will like bounce out from behind the door with Gatling guns, and he'll pull out a katana and just start killing mobsters so he can still keep his peanut butter sandwich territory. And then he gets home and he's got a nymphomaniac girlfriend who looks kind of like an alien. And she's always wanting to have sex with him. And he's like, but damn, baby, I got to make all these peanut butter sandwiches. It's like, that makes no sense to me, right? But I read it and I have such an appreciation for it because it's just spontaneous. And like if I was writing that story, I'd be like, but why does the cat like peanut butter sandwiches? You know what I mean? Like, I'd be trying to figure it out, and it would all just break down under the weight of it, you know?
What's in those?
And so Jim Rugg isn't – yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
What's in those peanut butter sandwiches?
Yeah, yeah, you know what yeah. I mean? So, Jim Rugg is another one of those guys. You know, he does like Aphrodisiac and what was the skateboard book that he did that was real popular? I can't see it on my shelf right now. Ugh, it's a really good book. But anyways, you know, just a spontaneity, you know, Jim Rugg and Brian Maruca, I should actually say, they do those books together. But it's that spontaneity that I really appreciate, but I don't necessarily see myself as competing with it, you know. It's just, I think it's like all things, you know, if you have a best friend or whatever, the reason why you're so close with them is because there's qualities in them that you see that you don't have yourself, you know. And so but
he has pretty much all the qualities I have.
But you know, and it's the same thing with writing. You know, the writing that I tend to admire is the writing that I don't see that I would be able to do myself. You know,
that makes sense. Well, actually, there was a story that Fred told us about. I believe you were in a comic book shop and told the person selling the books that you were the writer of EXO or something like that. And does this sound familiar at all to you? Can you repeat
that? Yeah. No, I was in Reno, Nevada. We went out to go skiing and at Lake Tahoe or whatever. Not in the lake, obviously, but in Tahoe. But we stayed in Reno, and so some comic book shop in Reno, and like we stopped to fill up the car. It was me and my wife and I, every year we go on a trip with two sets of neighbors. So it's the six of us. And so we stop at a gas station to fill up the car. And literally, like, the gas station shares a building with a comic book shop, right? I don't even remember what the shop was called. But everybody was like, oh, we got to go in the shop. You know, we got to go in the shop or whatever. My first issue of Green Lantern was not out yet. I was working on the book. It had been announced that I was going to be doing the book because I actually did some interviews while I was out there, but my issue wasn't out yet. So at this point, I'm just writing EXO Manowar. So I walk into the store, and my friends are all there, and I already know what's going to happen, right? Because this is just how it is. And so I say to the guy, yeah, you know, I write EXO Manowar for Valiant. He goes, yeah, EXO Manowar. We don't really sell it that well here. Like, that's what he said to me. And I was like, okay. It was nice talking to you, you know. Oh, we do good with Shadow Man, though. I was like, okay. Yeah. All right. Just turned around and walked out, you know.
we had a great laugh given the way the last show ended, you know, with Mo going on about Archer and Armstrong and how much he loves Archer and Armstrong.
That was a good book.
You know, and then we hear the story and I'm like, wow, you know, you seem to get that a lot.
Yeah. Archer and Armstrong is a good book. And again, that's that spontaneity. Also, you can see that in Fred's writing, right? Yeah. Like, I could never conceive of the kind of stuff that he's doing over there because I would try to make too much sense of it, you know? And what makes it work is that it's spontaneous, yeah. You know, and it holds up to its own internal logic, but it isn't necessarily the logic of the outside world. You know what I mean? So, yeah.
He was a really fun interview. Speaking of which, we had another recent interview with Kevin Eastman, creator of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Mm-hmm.
And he mentioned to us, what was the quote, Brad, about can't break toy?
Well, he when talking about the movies, one of the elements, especially with the new movie, and what he liked about Avengers is the fact that he doesn't think that you should break, you know, people don't want you to break their toys. Mm-hmm. You know, so when you go in there and when you create these new, like, you do something in the movies and your kind of fans feel like their toys are getting broken because you're doing something different. Mm-hmm. The Avengers didn't do that in his mind is what...
Yeah, and he was just being careful, talking about being careful And, you know, with the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movies, do not break people's childhood toys. And that's what they're sensitive about.
And I like, we likened that really, especially to the whole Wally West concept.
That was what I was going to say. I mean, I think that's kind of the Wally West thing, you know. You know, I don't.
I mean, it's obviously it's not you because DC was the one who came down with the whole edict, and so I mean,
sure.
it's their toys. They theoretically they can break them if they want to.
I don't know. I mean, I hope I'm not breaking the toys. You know what I mean? Even though it's DC's edict, I would hope that
they're repainting the toys.
Anything you're writing, I mean, that you know, how do you approach it? Do you worry about that? Do you think about that? I can do so much with it, but I can't break their toys. I can't, you know. I mean, let's face it. I mean, reader psyches can be fragile.
What could?
Reader psyche can be fragile.
Yeah, I mean, I think you just don't want to break the concept is what you don't want to do, right? Like, if the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles were, you know, Teenage Mutant Ninja Dogs, right? Like, you broke the concept.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't think you can break the concept. But other than that, I think you can do pretty much anything, honestly. I mean, at least in terms of what I would leave myself open to as a writer, you know. The stories have to hold up to their own internal logic and those kinds of things. But I do agree that I think that in terms of Wally West, I think that's probably what some of the people's reaction to it was, and I don't begrudge them that reaction, you know. I think, though, that dealing with the New 52 – it's not that we're breaking the old toys. The New 52 is an entirely new set of toys now. You know, like that's what the New 52 is supposed to be. That's what its mission statement was. That's how it was conceived, you know, is to do all those kinds of things. So I think to me, breaking the toy of Wally West would be him not becoming a hero. Him not becoming the Flash, or him, you know, what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
Like that to me would be breaking the concept of Wally West, him not taking that journey.
As I said earlier, I think the idea of Wally West can be the same. He can look different, but who Wally West is, I mean, you mentioned earlier, it was about the fact that he had this hero he placed on a mantle. And in his mind, he was always chasing that hero, even when he had surpassed him. In his mind,
sure.
He was still chasing that hero. And that was a relatable concept to the reader. I can get that. I get chills just thinking about that because in my life I felt that myself.
But it has nothing to do with the way he looks.
No,
that concept couldn't be with anybody.
Yeah, right. So that's what I mean. Like to me, the concept of Wally, I don't think is his physical appearance. I think the concept of Wally that you don't want to break is that journey that he takes. You know, and so what we're trying to do is do that journey, but do it in a way that is different and fresh, and we'll still hopefully be able to surprise people. Like we've already shown you, in some respects, the end, right? We showed you 5 years from now that him and Barry are great friends. We did that on purpose. Like, look, here's where we're going to end up. And now our challenge is to try to surprise you in how we get there, right?
Well, like, so you're going to be writing this for 5 years?
That's a unique challenge to have to try to do as a writer.
Made a five-year commitment to what? Awesome.
Flash.
That's great. Glad to hear that.
I mean, that's the challenge as a writer, you know.
Well, one of the things that we talk about a lot, especially with superhero comics, is just the idea that, you know, everything can be undone in an instant. You know, you can always go back. So, like, how far do you feel as a writer that you can go? I mean, do you feel like you can go pretty much anywhere and do anything, or is there kind of like some sort of, you know, great wall around the whole thing that you feel like you can't necessarily go into?
I don't know. I mean, there's some things that I guess I wouldn't do, but I think if you look at the kind of stories that I've done so far, you know, with Lights Out and what I've done with Hal, or you know, jumping into the Wally West story the way that we did, I mean, I would say that I'm not, if anything, I'm not risk averse when it comes to writing, right? You know, like, if I feel like I have a good story, then I'm going to tell the story, and I'm going to hope people like it. And ultimately, that's all you can do. I can't sit there and say, oh, but what if this or what if that? You know, like, if you're scared of what you're writing, then you're probably writing the right things, you know, because you're supposed to be outside your comfort zone. You're supposed to be pushing yourself to the edge, because hopefully that energy and that conflict and comes out, you know, almost that uneasiness comes out on the page, right? Because you want the reader to not know what's going to happen. You want them to you know, what's going to happen now? You know, we don't know. And so I think that introducing Wally West as a dead person on the ground, and that's the first time you ever see the character, is potentially risky. You know what I mean? It's definitely not what people would expect, you know? It's not safe. It's not comforting or anything like that. So, but I felt like it was a good story, and it is a good story, and that was a good way to kick it off. And so that's why we did it the way we did it.
Yeah, I have four questions I want to get to.
Four questions.
To you, and then...
Well, I'll ask a really... What should be a really simple one for you. So, Relic, we were talking about this earlier, just and about how when he, you know, he's part of the wall now there, but, like, so what are three ways that he could come back?
Oh, come on! Even I wouldn't ask that. And I'll ask anything.
If you wrote the book, that would be one way.
Yeah,
that's...
When you write
No, I mean, you know, nobody's ever been free from the source wall, right? That's what made Kyle so special. Like, he went through and he came back, and now everybody's like, and nobody knows he's alive except for Kyle and
I. Him in the car. I'm like, so Relic's gone. This is great character. Yeah. He's gone. Nobody comes back from that except one person did, but nobody comes back from that. What can you?
Yeah, so I mean, that's kind of the deal. And when we were writing, when I was writing a story and I was plotting it out, to me, I felt like that was a very satisfying end for him. Like, death doesn't matter to him at this point. He finally found out that this thing that he dedicated his whole life to was real. And he validated his entire existence. Like, I don't know. Once you've validated your entire existence, why do you need to be alive anymore, right? Move on to the next plane at that point. You know what I mean? You've done what you came here to do. And so I felt like as a scientist, he went out in the way that he absolutely would want to go out the way. He would rather prove his theory true and die than never prove his theory true and live forever, right? So I feel like I did him justice.
Perfect. Then somebody else, though, could come along because it's DC's toys someday and bring him back when you're not there.
Sure, they could. Yeah. Or I could. If I come up with an idea and I think it's a good story and a good way to bring him back, then I could do it.
Speaking of bringing back... I don't know if you can answer this or not. Are you aware of why it was that DC chose not to bring Wally West back originally with the launch of the New 52 and brought him back now?
Yeah, I have no idea.
You have no idea. Yeah. So that'd be the first thing I'd ask him. All right, I'm going to write it for you. Why didn't you have him?
Well, the interesting thing is, like, the Flash that I know, even though I'm probably at the wrong age for that, the Flash that I know is the Barry Allen Flash because of the TV show that was on when I was younger. Which I actually loved. Mm-hmm. It was on for a very brief amount of time, the John Wesley Shipp show, but I really enjoyed it. So he was the Flash that I knew, the Flash who worked in the crime lab and all this kind of stuff. So, yeah, they never told me. I never thought to ask why. If I had to guess, it would be because if you start out with Wally, then I don't think you can use Barry ever, really. But if you start out with Barry, you lead to Wally, right? Because that's what the continuity was.
Of course,
previously.
You have Bart out there too.
Yeah. And if you're reintroducing, I'm just thinking this out loud, but if you're going to reintroduce Wally West to the New 52 and there never has been a Barry, then Wally never took that journey.
No.
Right? So I think you've kind of broken the concept at that point.
I'd
right?
agree with that.
I think the toy would be broken.
And there's a lot of speedsters that are being... That were introduced, and especially during Mark Waid's run, that were really, really cool. That maybe I'm guessing you have some ideas for. But
I really liked Max Mercury.
I love Max Mercury.
Yeah, and I also liked the villain Savitar that he came up with too. I like Savitar a lot. Yeah.
So another question in issue 30. I'm not sure if this was you or Van Jensen who wrote this piece of dialogue, but there's a bit in the prison where Barry is talking to Mogul, and he mentions going to Canada because he enjoys poutine. Fries, gravy, cheese. Have you ever had poutine?
I have not. That was Van's line. Yeah,
is it delicious?
Yeah,
you
that's
have no
the
idea.
That's the annual. I have no idea what poutine is.
You have no idea what poutine is. Well, that'll bring me to my next question. We just had the Calgary Comic and Entertainment Expo. Greg Rucco was up here. We had a chance to talk with him, and he was great. You didn't come, by the way.
They actually asked me to come, but by that point I'd already committed to WonderCon, I got home from WonderCon on like a Monday, and I would have had to leave for Calgary on a Thursday, and I live in Atlanta, you know, so You know, that's a lot. But I told them, you know, if you want me to go next year, I'd be happy to go. Right. But I already
stay at his house.
Absolutely, it's true. I'm sorry? You could stay here. That's fine.
Oh, is that where you guys are?
Yeah, in Calgary. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I would love to go. I've heard it's a really good show. And only time I've ever been to Canada was to drive around to see Niagara Falls from the other side of the border.
And you so, come here, we'll definitely take you for some great poutine. But
I would love it. Yeah,
that'd be terrific. But one of the things that he mentioned to us, we were talking to him, and he was always talking about the characters, and Greg was always referring to them in their first names, and I thought that was very interesting to see how his mind worked. That's who the character was. It wasn't. You never referred to Superman as Superman. Superman as Cal, and Wonder Woman isn't
Clark,
Wonder Woman.
Actually,
no, Cal.
Was it? Oh.
Yeah, it was Cal. To me, he's Clark, which is interesting. If I think of Superman, I don't think of Superman. I think of Clark.
Who is this writer you're talking
Greg
about?
Greg Rucka.
Greg Rucka, okay.
He thinks of Cal. He thought Wonder Woman as Diana. So when you're thinking of the characters, do you think of them as Barry? Do you think of them as Hal? Or do you think of them as Green Lantern and the Flash?
No, I think of them as Hal and Barry. And when I talk about them, generally I talk about them as Hal and Barry. With the Flash, it's a little bit different because this first arc that we're doing, by introducing Wally West, we're introducing him in a way very specifically that he's going to relate to Barry differently than he's going to relate to the Flash because he doesn't know they're the same person. Mm-hmm. And so in that regard, I speak about them differently. But like when I talk about Green Lantern, I always talk about Hal.
Exo,
you know, when I talk about Exo Man of War, I always say Eric. Yeah. You know, I don't know. I've never thought about it, but I would guess the reason for that is because, you know, they're who they are because of the characters that they are, not because of the suits they wear. You know.
And when are we getting my Green Lantern Exo crossover? When's that happening? Yeah.
Once all the lawyers get straightened out.
See, that's the same answer as 10 and a half months ago. Yeah. One of the things that you did mention 10 and a half months ago, and I'm not sure where you want to go with this, but you mentioned to us that you were working on some creator-owned stuff, and you were just about to announce it.
That was the novel.
That was the novel. Oh, okay.
That was a novel, yeah. That's, you know, it's just, we hadn't announced it at that point. I think the announcement finally went out maybe around San Diego of last year, around Comic-Con last year. I think the first time anything was ever put in print about it was when I did my interview with USA Today for The Flash. I mentioned it. But, yeah, I mean, that's a big creator-owned project. You know, that's not comics, that's novels. And me not being the fastest writer, writing two novels takes up a lot of time. So I think a lot of people are like, well, how come Rob, you know, doesn't do creator-owned comics anymore? You know, it's a mainstream sellout or whatever. And it's like, no, I'm writing novels now. And they take up a lot of times.
One of the things actually it seems like is, oh, is he still there?
So that's the reason your own comics projects. What'd you say?
I'm sorry, we lost you for just a second there, but it's okay. Yeah, because one of the things that we seems to be an arc within many writers in the industry right now is you know, they come in, they break into the industry in the independents, then they go and work for the mainstreams, then they leave and they might stay and do something else for one of the big two, or they might go back and do their own thing. But that seems to be a very common pattern that we're seeing.
Yeah, and I think there's just as many people who leave the big two and then go to independent as well. You know, they build up a fan base for themselves and then they go over to Image or whatever have you. I think we've seen a migration of a lot of writers do that recently with, you know, Brubaker, Brian K. Vaughan. You know, I'm sure there's others. But to me, I like a balance of the two, you know. I think that it's two different styles of writing. Like if I'm writing creator-owned, something like Surrogates, I can do whatever I want because it's my own creativity. I mean, there's no constraints on me, right? But if I'm writing something that's work for hire, constraints are put on me in terms of, you know, maybe there's some big event going on in the whole universe, or, you know, we want you to go in this direction with the character or whatever. And those constraints lead to a whole nother kind of creativity because now instead of me building the box, you've put me in the box and I got to find my way out. And it's flexing an entirely different set of creative muscles. So for me, I enjoy both of them because they allow me to do different styles of writing.
Okay. Top three, top five, whatever you want to go with, Green Lantern villains.
Goldface.
Relic, obviously. Goldface,
one. Yeah, Goldface is number one and four, I'm guessing. No. <right.
laughs> let's see. Yeah, I mean, you got to go Sinestro, obviously. Not a big Hector Hammond guy. Monvel, I guess, maybe. Not Cyborg Superman.
Black Hand?
Yeah, I don't know. He gets kind of into that horror thing, you know? I mean, he's all right, but he kind of freaks me, creeps me out. You know? I don't know who I would say for the third one.
All right, is it easy?
I mean, I do really like Sonar, but only because of the idea that I came up with for him.
Is it easier? Can you do it?
His tuning fork gun is really kind of goofy, you know? I'm trying to think of all the people that were in the science cells. Bofunga is obviously very fun, but I wouldn't call him a villain of HAL, you know? I really like the story. I mean, he's gone now, obviously. But I like the story where Amansur comes back and he's trying to get the ring. I thought that was a really interesting story. I enjoyed that arc a lot.
And how about for the Flash? I mean, the Flash Rogues is legendary.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Grodd, my favorite.
Yep. Awesome.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, what don't you like about super genius gorillas, you know?
It's true.
And so definitely Grodd. Me of being a super genius gorilla on occasion.
Or at least a gorilla.
Okay, they've accused me of being a gorilla.
Yeah.
yeah, definitely Gorilla Grodd. Not just Flash, but one of my all-time favorite villains that I've come across so far would be Grodd. Captain Cold is a part of this. One of the, I mean, I love Captain Cold from the sense that all the rogues actually, they're just these blue-collar guys. You know, they just want to knock over a bank and drink a beer on Friday. You know, and I find that very relatable. You know, again, like the Flash high concept is relatable. I think the rogues are very relatable in that regard. So I would definitely put Captain Cold on that list. I got to write a scene with him in 32. That's one of the scenes I was telling you about earlier that I was really happy with how it turned out. And actually, you know, when I started out looking at Flash in the very, very beginning, you know, like they're asking me to pitch on Flash. And so I'm going to go to Wikipedia and read about the Flash, you know. I thought Mirror Master was the goofiest thing I'd ever heard of in my life. But actually, having read some stories and having written some stuff with Mirror Master, I actually think he's really cool now. So I guess I would say Mirror Master.
Mirror Master, Grant Morrison turned me around on his appearance actually in Animal Man all these years ago. It's brilliant. That's actually where I turned around on the character because I thought he was goofy too. Though once you read the Carrie Bates, The Trial of the Flash, if it's not Professor Zoom, a.k.a. the Reverse Flash, I'll be amazed. But yeah, I mean, there's, you know, he's got a lot of fun. You got a lot of fun toys to play with there.
Yeah, we gave I don't know, a trial of the Flash is you're saying Reverse Flash is in it. Is it the Eobard Thawne Reverse Flash?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, yeah, we name dropped him for you in the annual.
Yeah, you did.
Rob was eating his brain.
You did. Nice.
So he does exist in the New 52.
Well, like I say, once you read that, then you're gonna be like, oh, this is really good stuff. I mean, it's one of those books that actually is one of the reasons why I'm still here, you know? Is you read books that good and you go, I'm going to spend the rest of my life trying to find something that good again.
Yeah, I think Mark Waid did a good job with Return of
Barry
Allen.
Oh, that was a great story.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, the thing is, I mean, obviously, you have to keep in mind at the time that it was actually being published, I was reading comics back then. and we didn't know if that actually was or wasn't Barry Allen, you know?
Oh, really?
You know, I mean, there wasn't, I mean... We didn't think it was, but it could have actually been the Return of Barry Allen.
I mean, when I read it, I didn't know that it wasn't, you know?
Hmm?
When I read it, I didn't know that it wasn't.
Oh, you didn't? Yeah, so that's what makes it a key. If you know that's not actually him, then it reads differently.
No, I didn't know until I got to the end.
Oh, okay. Okay.
All right, well, I mean, that's... I think we've gone pretty long here. I mean...
Oh, yeah, I mean, absolutely. You got writing to do. You're going to be up till midnight. But we're looking forward to when you come up to Calgary. We're going to get you some poutine. You know, the other thing...
What is it now? Explain to me exactly what it is.
Okay, so it's French fries, it's gravy, it's cheese curds.
What kind of gravy?
Depends.
Like gravy you would put on turkey or...
Yeah, or you know, generally like... Yeah, I suppose beef gravy in most cases, but
there's different options.
Except the fries in the gravy, or it's all
it's just a big sloppy mess that you just dump on top.
Nowadays, sometimes people put sausage in it, and so it's fancy. You know,
they make butter chicken poutine and the like.
Delicious. See, I would be down for that. That sausage one sounds pretty good. Now, is that your meal? Or is that like a side?
You can get it as a side at some places. But some would actually make it as a meal.
Yeah. But like when you were kids, did you have like poutine for dinner?
Well, no, because we're not from Montreal, so we're not a little more prevalent.
But is that what it's like? Is it like Canadian mac and cheese? Like you could just eat this for dinner if you wanted to?
No, you know what's Canadian mac and cheese actually is mac and cheese.
Oh, really? Well, in the South, like mac and cheese is huge down here, right?
Actually, so
like
Canadians eat more.
You could either get it as a side, or you could just have it as a meal. Some places, like that's the meal. It's just mac
Canadians
and cheese.
Canadians eat, actually, scientific fact, more mac and cheese than any country in the world.
For real.
For real. Jealous. All right. Now he's thinking about moving.
Is it like Kraft out of the box macaroni?
There's
cheese?
A lot of that.
Yeah, it probably would be. I personally don't eat that much of it, but
somebody told me you guys are like crazy with potato chips up there. Like your potato chip aisle has like crazy flavors and all kinds of stuff that we don't get.
See, that's interesting because every time I go to the U.S., I look and I think like, oh, look at this. There's so much. Mind you, most of them are hot flavors, which I'm for. I'm very pro hot. Style potato chips, but you know, I think it's always the grass is greener element because, you know, but I can imagine if an American comes to Canada, they'd be like, oh my God, I actually get to drink real beer. And see, when we go down and when we go down there.
All right, so tell me what's a real beer.
Oh, once you have the beer up here, you'll never want to leave. Actually,
what's a real beer? Tell me what a real beer is.
Well, I'm a big fan of the Rickard's White. Actually, I think that's a really good beer. But the Alexander Keith's is very good. Like even I don't drink a lot of the true like Canadian and you know stuff like that.
What's the one with the moose on it?
Moosehead.
Moosehead's so
excellent.
Good.
Moosehead. Yeah.
Okay. Is that any good?
Yes.
Yeah.
Moosehead.
Okay. So yeah, when you come up here, you're coming out with us. We're going to go drink Moosehead, eat poutine.
You'll feel like an honorary Canadian.
I'm down for it. I love going to I like going to the shows that are in places I've never been. And I don't want to go eat at some place that I know. Like, I mean, I don't want to go eat anything crazy, but I want to eat whatever's local.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to go eat Moroccan in Calgary. You know what I mean? Like, I want to go eat poutine and drink Moosehead.
97,000. So I think it's one of the top five now, I think, with that. One of the top five conventions.
I've heard great things
and
about it. Andy,
it's a convention
really
that...
spent a couple just, times. And,
it's an app.
Like I say, I would have gone. I was just committed somewhere else.
Yeah, no, it's an affluent city. So there's also the people, they sell a lot of stuff here, which is one of the advantages. But here's one of the...
Yeah, I mean, for me as a writer, I don't... What am I
going to
sell?
I can see that.
I tried that, that's how I ended up being a writer.
That's actually, we felt really bad for Greg Rucka because he didn't have that much stuff to sell, and so by the time we actually just got to see him, he was literally down to about five Lazarus patches and that was his table.
All you have is books, but like how much books can you bring around? You know, this stuff weighs a lot.
Some people do.
But you get rid of it all and then you're so you only have to transport it one way. Get Ray Fox, who writes, you know, with you at DC there. I mean, he brought a bunch of stuff. He was sold out by Saturday.
Yeah.
Huh.
So then that Peter David just brings a bunch of scripts. You know, scripts that he wrote, and he prints them off on his own printer, staples them up, signs them for you, sells them to you for, you know, $5-$10, whatever it is.
No kidding,
yeah,
really?
Yeah. Just to give me any ideas. There you go.
There you go. Because you have to be able to pay for our beer and our poutine.
Your poutine. Yeah.
I mean, you're the big rich Flash and Green Lantern,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's right.
Loaded.
But it'll be good time. So I think we'll let you get back to writing. You probably have 2 or 3 hours to go there.
Yeah, sure. I appreciate it, guys.
Armor Wars.
Yeah, thank you so
much.
So,
any other things you want to plug, or are we going to anything? You want to hold up that Exo Manowar for a screenshot for this show, or?
Oh yeah.
Oh,
can you
take one here, Brett?
Yeah, that's right. Hold up something.
The Return of Robert Venditti, the Revenge. What are we going to call this one?
I don't know.
The Vengeance of Robert. You're a great guy. Yep. We really, really appreciate your time. I hope you had fun.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Whatever you guys need, just let me know.
Thank you so much, Rob. We totally
thanks, guys.
And we look forward to seeing your next issues of everything.
Yeah, and the Return of Goldface. We're really looking forward to
it. You got it. It's gonna happen like pretty much never, but
thank you, sir.
Thanks, Rob.
Take care, guys.